We are pleased to inform you that you have a place at Potterversity.
Welcome to Potterversity, a Potter Studies podcast. This is episode 25, The Alchemy of Harry Potter. Joining us at Potterversity. Today, Emily Strand and I will talk with Dr. Anne Mamory about the alchemical elements of the Harry Potter series. I am Katie McDaniel, professor of history at Marietta College in Marietta, Ohio, and co-editor of Harry Potter for Nerds 2.
And I am Emily Strand, instructor of comparative religions and cultural competency at Mount Carmel College, and author of several Harry Potter essays.
Today, we are going to be talking about alchemy in Harry Potter, and a part of our discussion is going to look at how reading itself can affect an alchemical transformation in the reader. Emily, how do you know when something you've read has been transformational for you?
Well, I would probably expand this to, because you know I love the Star Wars,
all right,
to include something I've watched as well. Because I, for a long time, I always thought that I knew a good movie that I'd seen because I wouldn't be able to stop thinking about it easily. Uh-huh. And I think that that is probably also the mark of good literature. Like, I will tell you right now, I'm finishing up a long book that I've been reading that I honestly can't wait to be done with. But other books, you know, you'll close that last page and, or you'll close the book and it's just, it really stays with you and different parts of it, different aspects of it, maybe those aspects that you don't quite understand. And I think that's key also, those aspects that you don't quite understand that cause you to continue to ruminate on them and think about, just think about the themes and everything. So I think that that's probably my biggest clue is when my brain just keeps worrying around. What about you? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, very similar to that, I would say, in the sense that you know, you keep thinking about it. But I would also say, like, when I find myself making analogies to my life, you know, it's like, oh, this is like when Hermione was, you know, and yeah. Like you sort of have that sense that this book was, you know, presenting some kind of metaphor through which you can maybe understand your own life at a little bit better level. And I would add, when I find myself telling other people about this book, you know, this is the book, right? And I found out this thing and, you know, here's this idea that I got, and I'm really trying to think about how that can change the way that I interact with the world that I'm living in. And I think that's when I know that a book has had a real impact on me. And sometimes mm-hmm. I'll find that a book is not transformational, maybe the first time I read it, but if I read it at the right time in my life,
right,
I see things like, oh, wow, I didn't really realize that all of this was there. It's not as though they're two categories, transformational right. and the not transformational. I think sometimes, you know, it has to hit you at the right moment. You, the reader, have to be ready for the transformation.
Right, right. It's fun to watch that in young people too. Whereas mm-hmm. like certain books that I've handed my child, you know, he's been more or less interested in, but then sometimes it's just a matter of the timing, you know, where like he started reading The Dark is Rising like maybe a year ago, but he'd never latched onto it. And I think I'm like, oh, it's just a little too soon. Mm-hmm. I should have waited until 11 because, you know, 11's a magical age in that book and in Harry Potter. So it is interesting to see how those, it has to be, the timing has to be right. It's like an alchemical process.
Yeah. Well, and I was thinking like that age also. So my mom used to love teaching the middle school ages, the junior high ages, because she said, this is when kids are becoming.
Yeah, this it's a liminal where they're space.
Becoming. Yeah. And so what better time to be reading in a way that can be transformational to you also. And I think that's a lot of what, you know, Harry Potter readers have experienced. You know, they themselves, they see themselves in these characters, maybe similar ages. And so I'm excited to have our guest tell us more about alchemical transformations in Harry Potter and, you know, what Harry Potter can do for readers as well. And so to help us understand that a little bit better, we are joined today by Dr. Anne Mamory, professor of philosophy at Monmouth College, where she teaches a class called Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Soul. She is the editor of the book, The Alchemical Harry Potter, Essays on Transfigurations and J.K. Rowling's Novels, published by Macfarlane in 2021. So a really recent book. Welcome to the show, Anne.
Well, thank you. It's really wonderful to be here. And when you were talking, I was thinking, yes, exactly. This is an alchemical relationship between reader and book. And the alchemists, alchemists were not thinking only about turning lead into gold, but they're working on the world and the world is working on them. And it's a mutual transfiguration. And so I think that the book and the readers grow with each other. I mean, of course, page 13 is still page 13. But if you come to, if you come to page 13 at a different point in your life, the second time around, it could strike you in a completely different way. Mm-hmm. So I like that idea that you brought up, that it's kind of an alchemical relationship between book and reader. And years ago, when I was, you know, I've been teaching this course for quite a long time now, and we were talking about the students growing up with the books, but then one of them said, the books have grown up with us. And I thought, yes, that's exactly right. That's why they are so powerful. You can read them on so many different levels at so many different ages, and they do change. The words on the page don't, but how they strike you does. So it's an alchemical relationship between reader and book, I think, depending on where you are in your life. And also the books prime you the first time around to read them differently the second time around. So they're participating in that relationship as well.
Right. And I love the idea of rereading that comes through in several of the essays in the book. And we are big fans of the rereading process. So tell us, Anne, how did you first get interested in the Harry Potter books? And when did you start thinking about them as a subject for academic scholarship?
Well, I have to admit that, well, if you look at my bookshelf, you can tell when I got interested in them. The first two I have in paperback, I didn't, you know, I was in my 30s. What's all the fuss about? This can't be all it's cracked up to be, right? So I think I was on sabbatical and I just picked up the first book and I'm just going to try it because I don't want to dismiss it without knowing what I'm dismissing. And right away, it occurred to me that these are powerful because they can get an 11-year-old's interest. There's all kinds of really fun stuff. And also, as an adult, there were kind of guides for living. I'm watching this 11-year-old, it's hard enough to be 11, but going through what Harry's had to go through, it occurred to me that these books have interest, not just for the ages they're written for, but for everybody. And I think one thing Rowling does brilliantly is, how do you move from 11 to 12? Especially when the characters who are in the first year are almost a year apart. I mean, Hermione turns 11 a year before school starts, so she's 12 in September, and Harry just turned 11 at the end of July. And Rowling is brilliant, I think, at moving from age to age to age. She does that really well. But also, there's so much background. You don't have to have that background when you're a kid, although some of the kids do get that. But as an adult reader, that background stuff caught my attention. And I didn't know at the time that Rowling was a classics major or that she'd studied French and literature. I'm not surprised, I guess, but that stuff started shining through for me as I was reading with my interest in ancient philosophy. So really, it was an accident. Serendipity is one of my favorite words. And I just picked this book up because there it is. It's popular. I've got to find out why it's popular. And then when book three came out, there I was at Barnes & Noble at midnight with a bunch of teenagers who are wearing Hogwarts robes to get the third book, as if we were on platform 9 3/4, getting ready to go to another world. You know, when Travis Pinsey writes about a way between two worlds, it's literally that train, but it's also reading these books take you to a different world and you come back out transformed. Yeah, so first I wasn't thinking about this as academic scholarship. I was thinking about these students have grown up with Harry Potter. Wouldn't it be great to have a course? They don't know about all of the incredible secondary literature. And there was even in 2012 when I started teaching the course, and more has come along. And then I thought, how can I teach this course every year? I'm going to get bored in a hurry. Well, no, I'm not. There are 20 different young people in front of me every time. And they also, I mean, here's this alchemical relationship again. They also change how I see the books. Things stand out for them that maybe would have gone right by, you know, right over my head. And so having that different group of students every year has also made the books have more and more interest, but also then got me thinking about an academic look at the books. And so, speaking of serendipity, a lot at the beginning, the students really had grown up with the books. And more recently, some of the students have seen the movies, but they haven't read the books. So it's kind of fun to read the books with them when they're going through them the first time as adults, and then comparing and contrasting the movies with the books. So sabbaticals are wonderful, right? So I'm in Northern New York. I met a woman who was at Clarkson University where I used to teach, but she wasn't there when I was there, and I had fed her cat. And so she invited me over for her birthday celebration. And I pointed to the video of Order of the Phoenix on her bookshelf. And she picked it up and said, look who wrote the screenplay, Michael Goldenberg. Who's in the kitchen lighting her birthday candles? Michael Goldenberg. They were a couple. The next year they rented my house in Northern New York, and then she left her job and moved to California, and they've been married for years now. Back
wow,
in the
how
day,
cool is that?
Totally cool. And talk about serendipity.
Yes, serendipity. Yeah,
definitely.
Thank you to Oliver the cat.
Right.
So, cats for the win.
Yes. So back in the quaint old days of Skype, Michael used to Skype in with my students. He stopped doing it. He said he's too far from the movie and he didn't want to do it anymore. But it was wonderful to talk about the adaptation of the books into movies. And sometimes students want them to be a one-to-one correspondence. And my favorite character wasn't there, my favorite scene. But then we had this chance to talk about, and this is part class, part academic, but they're all intertwined. But how do you transfigure or adapt a book for a screenplay? And so Goldenberg showed us his book with all of his notes in it. And he thought that the main theme was Harry's coming of age. It's hard enough to be a teenager, but what choices is he going to make? Will he be transformed in an alchemical way so that his life becomes a golden life, a spiritual life? Or is he going to take the isolation, maybe to protect his friends? But we saw what happened to Tom Riddle when he isolated. And so we talked about the transfiguring, the haunting. You know, the book is, well, we talked about the word palimpsest, which they didn't know. So seeing the original shining through the screenplay. And so it's been a wonderful way of making books and screenplays not the same thing. They're two different art forms, but they have a conversation with each other and what makes one work. And then seeing an interview with Rowling about how, you know, she's watching these movies before the books are completed. And so Alan Rickman playing Snape influenced how she wrote the character of Snape from then on out. So another alchemical interaction, books and movies shaping each other.
Yeah, I love that sense of, you know, that you talk about the filmmakers are transfiguring the material for the, you know, for the different medium, also with the idea that hopefully the movies will be able to then form an alchemical relationship with the viewers. And I know that not everybody thinks that was totally successful, but I think the popularity of the movies speaks to something that's really valuable. And you
it's
know,
hard to argue with. Yeah.
Yeah. The marathons that are constantly on in the holiday season. I think that they are successful in that.
Right. Speaking of transformations, the focus of the collection that we, you know, want to especially talk about today is alchemy in Harry Potter and alchemical transformation. So tell us, Anne, how is alchemy related to transformation and transfiguration? And why is that so important in the Harry Potter series?
So this is quoted several times in the anthology. There was an interview with Rowling who said that she never wanted to be a witch, but an alchemist, that's another story. And so that she studied alchemy to make it the underlying logic of the series. And so, you know, when I was a kid, I wanted to be a magician, and my parents obliged and bought me all these magic tricks. And also, you know, we're doing homemade stuff. And that got me interested in studying chemistry, which is what I did in college. If Harry Potter had been out when I was a college student, I would have realized what I wanted to do was alchemy. And chemistry was the closest thing at the time. Of course, philosophy, I didn't even know what that was.
Wow, that's so cool. I was thinking about that because cool. I saw that your undergraduate degree was in chemistry, but now you're doing philosophy. And I was like, that's perfect for alchemy.
Yes. And I went to Bryn Mawr, and if you see the architecture of the place, Bryn Mawr is Hogwarts in Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I was studying chemistry, and I was also studying women's studies. And I knew before I was in my senior year that I didn't really want to be a chemist, but I was also doing Morris dancing, which is a British folk dance. It used to be all men, and you've done it, you know, bazaars and at festivals, spring festivals and stuff. And so the chemistry professor who would lead the Morris dancing group, Dr. Zimmerman, would have been so disappointed if I had dropped chemistry. But chemistry and Morris dancing and women's studies are about transformation. And I didn't know at the time that Morris dancing also is an oral culture. It was passed down from people who did it to people who were doing it. And that was true for me. I mean, I didn't read about Morris dancing in a book and learn and study the steps. Dr. Zimmerman told me what to do, and I did it. I've been Morris dancing with a group of women in Binghamton, New York, since I was 27, and we named ourselves the B.F. Harridans, which was really funny when I was 27. It's changed meaning now. But so this oral transmission of ideas led me from Morris dancing, believe it or not, to a study of Plato, who was living on the cusp of an oral culture, and thinking about how people passed along knowledge, and the alchemists, not all of them, but many of them, you know, studied with other alchemists. So my study of chemistry, because it's magic, and Morris dancing, because I loved it, led me to Plato and a study of oral culture, which in part helped me to think about alchemy, partly because of Harry Potter, but partly before and in other contexts. And I'm, you know, thinking about modern science, thinking about the researcher being separate from the research, keeping yourself as distant as possible. But that wasn't my experience with wanting to be a magician or thinking about women's studies.
Yeah, that sort of idea of the neutrality of the experimenter being necessary for the result, which is a very modernist idea.
Yeah, definitely. And so you're reading a anthropologists or sociologists talking about how that's kind of impossible, that how you, and Sandra Harding in philosophy, how you, your cultural background shapes the questions that you ask. And so science, you know, tried as hard as it can to come up with answers that make sense. They always make sense in a context. And so the kinds of questions you ask are based on the background that you have. And somehow, I forget where I found this book, I started reading Bruce Moran's Distilling Knowledge, and that the title is very alchemical itself, because distillation is part of the alchemical transformative process, alchemy, chemistry, and scientific revolution. You know, he really was showing me something about the modern worldview. And I think my interest in Plato and alchemy, and my interest in contemporary feminist studies, they're both looking at this modern Western worldview with a disenchantment of nature and the idea that you can be neutral if you're a scientist. And so Moran is saying there's something that doesn't quite make sense about including a subject like alchemy in a discussion of scientific revolution. Science, after all, is rational and ordered. Alchemy, we think, presumes disorder and irrationality. Common sense tells us that there are certain classes of objects, certain kinds of knowledge, certain ways of going about discovering truths of nature that can be regarded as scientific. Alchemy, with its association with magic and the occult, doesn't belong here. And he goes on, he ends this paragraph with a question. It reminded me of the Quibbler, right? And clearly when he says, we think, and he asks, right? He's trying to get people who were raised in maybe the closing days of modernity, but there's still a lot of modernity in our world. He's trying to get us to rethink our assumptions that says chemistry and science is good and alchemy is just for weirdos. And he says, alchemy was sent to live with the metaphysically baddie great ants. And I love that, because the metaphysically baddie great ants, well, if we're making a trip to a new world, they're there, front and center. So I'm thinking about alchemy as a way of not only transforming metals or transforming the alchemists, but also how do we think about our own worldview? It's very difficult to do that because we're living in it. And there's a book about white privilege where somebody says to the fish, so how's the water? And the fish says, what the hell is water? How do you think about your culture's background when it's the air that you breathe and it becomes who you are? You know, so in feminist theory, the idea that the nurture becomes nature. We have this neuroplasticity as children. And the more you practice something, this goes way back to Aristotle, the more it becomes who you are. So we part of what we do in class, and what I had to rethink when I was working on this book, is what are our prejudices about alchemy? And Moran talks about how for the people who practiced it, it worked, it made sense, it was part of their worldview. And part of that is transforming how we think about certain things like nature being disenchanted.
Mm-hmm.
The modern worldview says nature is just a machine. Well, we're going to behave toward it in a certain way and ask certain scientific questions. But if nature is enchanted, if it's full of its own purposes, the wand chooses the wizard after all, it's just a stick, right? Then we have to think about the world, conceptualize the world in a different way. So we transform our background knowledge, and then alchemy comes to life. And you can see it in every page of Rowling's books, not just the obvious examples, but in how Harry and his friends are transfigured, and he can't be by himself. He needs his friends for that transfiguration.
You've got this process, alchemy, that is, you know, in one sense, a kind of chemistry precursor, although maybe not exactly the right way to characterize it, that has, you know, the search for the ability to transform, you know, base metals into precious metals, something like lead into gold. And then you're doing that through a variety of things that look like chemistry. And yet it's also infused with a kind of metaphysical idea that I think is in the Western tradition is very Christian, in the sense of, you know, that idea of that God is somehow working through this, like through the great chain of being. And so when you are then, you know, looking at this transformation of metals, the alchemist's ideas in this, you know, in this process are also infused with a kind of religious purpose or metaphysical search that, as you were saying before, is not just about finding this transformation in the metal, but it also is supposed to transform them as the experimenter. And there's a certain symbolism that comes through that, that then, you know, becomes a whole like symbol set through which we can understand transformation, transfiguration in a lot of other realms.
But I'd add that there were, of course, Christian alchemists, but also Jewish and Muslim and people who are not from the three monotheisms. I mean, some of the hints we get about alchemy, if we don't know about Rowling's underlying logic, I mean, we have the Philosopher's Stone, obviously. Alpheus Doge is talking about the trip he took after graduation. He would have taken with Dumbledore if he could have. Mm-hmm. He talks specifically about the Egyptian alchemists. So I think it's important. Cool. I think broadly, yes, the metaphysics, the idea that there is something heavenly in everything terrestrial. I think that's true. I don't want to say that it's exclusively Christian, although there are plenty of people in the anthology who write from that Christian perspective, but it doesn't have to be that. So I think it's really important that not only are the metaphysically batty great aunts part of this, I mean, it's no surprise that there are women headmistresses and healers throughout all of Hogwarts history, mm-hmm. because there were women alchemists, there were Jewish, Muslim, and Christian, and also non-monotheistic alchemists. But yes, the point is well taken.
Well, cool. No, I think that's great. I love that, you know, the kind of diverse perspectives. And when you've got, you know, a field like alchemy, like I love that it has, you know, it can have all these other dimensions, all these other people playing
but
around
I,
with it.
Yeah. And I also love that it's sort of fundamentally about spirituality, you know, and again, like you said, it doesn't have to be in a primarily Christian sense, although there were many Christians who were, you know, interested in alchemy for those metaphorical meanings. But it's a theosis process. It's a divination process, you know, where there's a collapse of the sacred distance between humans and God. And I think that's the real point. And, you know, when I read about it, I think of the Eucharist, you know, because this is exactly what we, in the Catholic tradition, in the best sense, when we're talking about the Eucharist, we're not splitting hairs over crumbs and, you know, what to do with spilled, you know, communion wine and things like that. What we're doing, you know, the best thing we do when we talk about the Eucharist is talk about our own transformation into not just individual Christs, but the body of Christ, a collective that does the work of God in the world, you know. And so, and that to me strikes very close to what you're talking about with alchemy. And alchemy is so cool because it has such a diverse background. You see these themes as not just Christian, but as universal. And that, I think I find that really helpful in helping people beyond their own individual worldview, personally.
Because you're reminding me of Harry's choice. He was willing to die for his community. and he walks into the woods, and Dumbledore reminded him earlier in the series that the people we love never really leave us. And he goes there with the support of his community, even people who are dead. They're walking with him. Nobody else can see him. And then he has a choice. He can go on, or he can choose to live for his community. You know, so the idea of, and this, maybe this is why I didn't go immediately to alchemy, because I was stuck on this critique of modernity with the mind-body split. But alchemy exactly does the opposite, like you were talking about. It isn't like the heavens are up here and the earth is here and we have to try to get away from earth. No, the heavenly is in the earthly. And alchemy helps you to find that, to make that, to transfigure your ideas, and to realize that there is the sacred in everything, not just every person, but every stone, every piece of wood. So I think that, you know, part of my, I have to confess, when I was a young graduate student, when you're 27 and you know everything, right? I did some serious Plato abuse because I thought he was trying to to move from this this world of, you know, the senses to the world of the forms. And there was something terrible about our physical embodied lives. But no, Socrates walked barefoot all over the place on the earth. And he was like an axis mundi, bringing the heavens to the earth and the earth to the heavens. For every time Plato has an ascent, he also has a descent. You have to go under the ground to come back up. And once you're up here, you have to go back underground again. So yeah, I've been trying to make up for Plato abuse. But I think that, I mean, this is what attracts me to alchemy also. The idea that there's not this mind-body separation, that we're not living in a world of just machines. We're living in an enchanted world in which the heavenly is not another realm. We're trying to distill that out of the physical world, but also then recognize that in each of us, there is this sacred thing, not in spite of being embodied, but because of it.
Yeah. You know, you all were making me think about, you know, you've got these different classes at Hogwarts. They don't teach alchemy at Hogwarts, but they do have divination, which was something that Emily said before. And there's transfiguration class. And, you know, there's astronomy and potions. So, you know, there are a lot of classes that have an alchemical, we'll call them interdisciplinary alchemy classes, right? So that they are actually, you know, all doing some of that alchemical training. And so when you're looking at the Harry Potter series, what are some cues that readers might have that alchemical transformation is actually at the heart of what's going on in these books?
So just one quick detour. And the idea of at a liberal arts college, we don't usually have classes that are called liberal arts.
Right.
One exception is here, we have the first year seminar is introduction to liberal arts, but we teach the humanities and the social sciences and the lab sciences, and we have music and theater and all this stuff. Nobody has to say, where's the class in liberal arts? Because we all have the context to know that those make up the liberal arts. And in the introduction to the alchemical Harry Potter, I said, there's not a class called alchemy because every single class put together is an alchemical education. Every single class teaches students how to work with each other, how to work with ideas, how to work with, if you're in potions, you know, how to work with physical things and to transform them and yourself then becoming transformed. You know, so if you're making potions, what are you going to do if you happen to make Amortentia? You know, Slughorn tells them this is the most dangerous potion. You can understand something about yourself. I mean, it's sort of another mirror of Erised. When you smell the Amortentia, you think of things that attract you most, but you have to also learn that love is not about enchanting someone in the way that Merope Gaunt enchanted Tom Riddle Sr. And she recognizes that herself. I mean, we just finished reading Gregory Basham's article, Love Potion Number 9 3/4, where he recognizes that using the potion showed that she did not love Tom Riddle Sr., but stopping using the potion, even though it made her die of a broken heart, she learned how to love. So there's something alchemical there that students learn about in a potions lesson. So every bit of the Hogwarts curriculum, I think, is an alchemical education. So there are obvious clues. The Philosopher's Stone in the first book.
Sure. And the big hint.
Dumbledore, you know, the Sorcerer's Stone business, that if the American publishers had known how famous she would have become, they probably would have allowed her to go with Philosopher's Stone. But anyway, but the lesson, this is an alchemical lesson. When Dumbledore tells Harry that people have a habit of choosing things that are worse for them, he's not saying alchemy is terrible. He says, as much money and life as you want, if you think about it, only gathering gold and getting immortality, you've missed the point. So we learn not only about the philosopher's stone, and we meet a historic alchemist, Paracelsus, on the chocolate frog cart, but he also teaches Harry, what does it mean to have gold? This is about transforming your leaden existence on Privet Drive into a golden one, and you need your mm-hmm. friends to do that. And what is, well, we learn by watching Tom Riddle Jr. what immortality means, and it's not what he's doing.
Mm-hmm.
So Harry and his friends put parts of their souls into each other. It doesn't diminish any of them. It makes them all collectively stronger. And Voldemort, he tears his soul by killing other people for self-aggrandizement, the wrong form of immortality. And when Slughorn tells him about the Horcruxes, he says, who would want this kind of life? Death would be better. So we're learning something about metaphysics and alchemy from a book written for 11-year-olds, which maybe I didn't see the first time I went through, but it caught something in me. So there's that. And as I mentioned already, Alpheus Doge talking about meeting the Egyptian alchemists, but there's a whole bunch more. And this is this transformation between two worlds. It isn't just that Harry is leaving Privet Drive and going to a world where he's going to learn arithmetic instead of math. And he did say to Hagrid, don't you know anything? Well, I can do math and stuff.
Yeah.
It's not just about different tools. He's going from one worldview to another worldview.
Mm.
And Prinzi, when he's talking about the importance of truth in fiction, he points to the Dursleys as caricatures of the Enlightenment. Mm-hmm. So this transportation between worlds is not just the Hogwarts Express, but it's going from one worldview to another worldview. And he's going to an alchemical worldview. I think that's really important. Thinking about the mirror of Erised and Dumbledore saying people have died, wasted away in front of this.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes students think that means get over it, get on with your life, forget about the tragedy of your parents' death. And that's not it at all. And I point to them the first ride on the train when Harry has money for the first time in his life and he buys everything from the trolley. And Ron has friends, he has family, you know, he's trying to stand out. What the two of them would see in the mirror, Harry, his parents, Ron wanting to be Quidditch captain, right? They look at each other on that train. They become the mirror for each other. Harry doesn't say, I've got stuff. You're poor. Ha, ha, ha. You know, Dudley would have done that. He, for the first time in his life, has something to share and someone to share it with. What a transformation from either Dudley or the Malfoys, where getting stuff makes you the best possible person. And for Harry, having someone to share the stuff with. And Ron loves being singled out. He has a new best friend. They enact what the Mirror of Erised shows them.
In a way, I love that reading. That's great.
It doesn't diminish them. It makes them both stronger.
Mm-hmm.
There's an alchemical scene right there before we know anything about it, but also the chocolate frog card with Paracelsus. So when I was thinking about alchemical transformations, going back to my Plato studies and thinking about Aristotle and the ancient world and the four elements, you know, the earth, the air, the fire, and the water, and then trying to find the fifth element, which is the quintessence. And the alchemists are trying to find the quintessence in the ordinary elements. And it's there all along, and they're trying to find it and then find it in themselves.
And the quintessence is that which is eternal and unchanging. Mm-hmm. And it's, I guess a lot of times in the Middle Ages, they thought that's what the heavens were composed of, this fifth element.
Like the star matter. Call it the star matter. Yeah. Star stuff. Yeah. Right.
Exactly. So I found Johann Rudolf Glauber's Quintessence, and the picture is on page 11 of the anthology. And looking at this picture reminded me so much of the picture of the Deathly Hallows on it's page 405, the beginning of the Deathly Hallows chapter of Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows. And I thought if I rotate this picture of the quintessence, right? So Glauber has the, around the edge of the image, separate what is pure from what is impure or morally foul. So we get this hint that this is about morality and metaphysics. And so we see that with the choices Harry makes, the choices that Ron makes versus what Dudley, until the very end, by the way, he does say he's sorry, or what Draco does. And maybe Draco has some change in him too, who knows, but there's always-
I'm with that, who knows? It's hard to tell.
There's always- always the chance until the bitter end for redemption in the Harry Potter books. And this moral question goes right till the last conversation that Harry has with Voldemort, where he says, be a man, try, you know, reconceptualizing masculinity, try for some remorse. This is how you put your soul back together. And so do we think there's something wrong with Hermione for stealing the book? No, not at all. She's the one who realizes that there's one way of putting your soul back together, remorse. You've got to truly mean it. And Harry gives Voldemort that chance until the bitter end. You know, he's not a lost cause until he doesn't take the chance for remorse. But anyway, so if we turn this picture of the quintessence, the three primes, the tria prima are there, sulfur, salt, and mercury. It looks like the picture of the Deathly Hallows, the triangle with the circle in the middle and the—
Oh, cool.
So there's the cloak and there's the resurrection stone and there's the elder wand.
Mm-hmm.
So the alchemist, working with things that look an awful lot like those hallows, sulfur, salt, and mercury. So in the anthology, but also in the Five Keys for the Serious Reader, John Granger, who's not related to Hermione, as far as I know, talks about transfiguration, the transformation of Harry's lead into gold. He can't do it by himself. He has his two best friends, Mercury, chemical symbol HG, Hermione Granger. Her parents were dentists. Dentists until fairly recently used mercury for fillings. Sulfur that can burst into flame. Ron, fiery Ron, who sometimes is rash with his red hair. And Harry, the salt of the earth, seeing in Glauber's quintessence, this philosopher's stone coming up again, transformed in the Deathly Hallows. So they look alike, but I think there's something metaphysically similar about them as well.
Yeah. Well, why don't we transition to talking about those Deathly Hallows and how you actually use the Deathly Hallows to subdivide the book by sections. So what do the Hallows symbolize? And then why did you choose each of those to focus a section?
Well, it's actually a kind of transformative reading of those Hallows because they can all be used for really nefarious ends. And Dumbledore reminds Harry that the cloak can protect the one who's wearing it, but can also be used to protect others. So as I'm thinking about the different ways that things can be used in the series, sometimes for good and sometimes for really serious, not so good. So I was trying to think about those symbols and thinking about the philosopher's stone and the transformation that the alchemist makes and wondering how these Deathly Hallows can be transformative, depending on how you use them. And so I was thinking about each one being at the beginning of a section and looking at a different kind of transformation. So the first section, I was thinking about the resurrection stone and the transfiguration or the transformation of desire. And it's just to brag a little bit, this, when you were talking earlier, Katie, about people talking about rereading, Isaac Willis, who wrote about the resurrection stone and his grief at rereading the series.
That's a really powerful essay. That's so, I thought so many people are going to relate to that essay about rereading.
And Isaac Willis was one of my students. He graduated from Monmouth in 2018. He's now getting an MFA in poetry at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign.
And it's beautifully written. When I read it, I was like, this guy is a writer. Yeah. And it's very much about that, you know, the idea that when you reread it, you've lost something from that first time that you read it. And sometimes, you know, there's a kind of grief that works on you when you're doing that. I thought it was a great essay. Love that one.
Yeah, Isaac is remarkable. And the first article in each section looks at alchemy historically, in addition to talking about their reading of these novels. So I was thinking about, in the first section, Resurrection Stone and the Transfiguration of Desire, we have John Granger wrote the beginning article for that section. It's a good way to start the anthology because he talks about the three stages of the alchemist's work, the black, the white, and the red. So speaking of the previous question, how do we find alchemical imagery in the series? When Granger talks about the black stage, the negredo stage, it's a breakdown or a dissolution of characters, usually by heat. Then there's the white stage or the albedo stage, which is a purification of the character, usually by water. And the red or the rubedo stage, the revelation of that transformation. And right away, we get some clues, albedo, albus. So there's this idea of luminescence, red, rubedo, rubeus, Hagrid, the revelation of some transformation, going to get Hagrid, or to get Harry from his miserable relatives who are the Negredo stage, breaking down Harry. So I think we can see in the characters' names and also these stages, the alchemical influence on the books. And Granger is careful to point out that the character doesn't happen alone, right? Other people engage that main character in the transformation process. So again, the alchemical mercury, the alchemical sulfur, they're there with Harry every step of the way. And they're really crucial to his transformation. It's sometimes tempting to read, and sometimes students do this, to read this as a battle between good and evil. It's Harry versus Voldemort, but I don't think it does that. And that's maybe too modern of good is over here and evil's over here. I mean, Sirius remind us of that, that the world isn't divided into good people and Death Eaters. We all have some of each in us. This is a journey that people have to take together. Harry can't do it by himself, and Dumbledore tells him that. So it's really a really important thing that this transformation in these stages, Harry's not by himself. So there's the discussion already when we look at those stages of those four elements of the ancients, the earth, the air, the fire, and the water being transformed, and a person finds the quintessence, the celestial in them.
Mm-hmm. And that in that first section, I like the idea of the transformation of desire. And the Mirror of Erised, as you were saying, I mean, it does reflect that, right? So the idea that, you know, you have desires, but they don't, this doesn't have to be the end point, right? That you can actually shift what it is that you are desiring, you know, as a result of the process that you've gone through.
Of course, he desires his family. He desires community. He desires not to be abused. He could sit in front of that mirror and waste away. And then they have all the power, the people who took his parents from him. Or he can say, my desire is to have this community. I see in my friend a desire for something else. How can we together make both of these things into reality? You know, in desiring, we see also Voldemort desiring to live forever. We see the Malfoys' desire to have political power and as much money as they can possibly carry. And that, if they follow through on those desires, is actually soul-crushing. Slughorn is right. It's better to be dead. And so transfiguring the desire for money into a desire for a golden life. And this doesn't mean that you desire necessarily to be in poverty. I mean, this is one thing I like about Plato. He talks about abject poverty being as terrible as greed. So it's not necessarily saying you have to give up everything that has to do with, you know, gaining wealth, but what do you do with it? You can't give something away if you don't have it. So when Harry gets money, his desire is to share it. And for him, that's a transfiguration of desire. And just another thing that Granger does so well is to talk about how the stages occur in all the books, but also across the series. And so I don't have to go into all the details, but I think that's really an important thing that he points out. So that's the beginning of the first section. And it helps people to understand that alchemy isn't just chemistry for idiots, that alchemy has its own logic, and that Rowling has got that logic.
Yeah, and then the second section, you're taking another of the Hallows. So you're taking the Elder Wand in this case, talking about the transfiguration of power.
So that in the Tale of the Three Brothers, that wand that can never be defeated, people use that to do horrible things for the most part. And they use it for self-aggrandizement. So the beginning, Sipple's missing element, and she uses Egyptian alchemical imagery. And she describes the chamber in the Chamber of Secrets as a metaphorical alembic, right? So the alchemical vessel for distillation. And so Harry goes into this chamber. He defeats the diary. He defeats the Horcrux that is the diary. And he himself is transformed. But he learns something about what power means there. You know, Ginny confides in that diary because she needs a friend. And unfortunately, because she's Ron's younger sister, she doesn't get the friendship she needs. I think what's wonderful about Ginny is she doesn't come out of that experience not trusting. She doesn't come out of that experience not wanting to have friends. Voldemort thinks power is taking advantage of her best instinct to reach out, to open her heart. And he uses that to strengthen himself. Again, the ripping apart of other people's hearts and souls for his own power. Harry not only goes to save his best friend's sister, but he finds out what power means there. He asks for help. Fox arrives with a smelly old sorting hat and the sword of Gryffindor. Help will always be given at Hogwarts to those who ask. Harry finds out that asking for help is not a weakness. He finds out that what Voldemort thinks is strength is pitiable. And being angry with someone, you see them as an equal. If you pity them, you see them as less than you are, and something that Voldemort never learns. He might if he chose Harry's advice at the end, but he doesn't. So a different kind of power. He asks for help. Help arrives. And so he's not willing to kill other people for self-aggrandizement. He's willing to give up himself to other people for the strength of the whole community. And when he has the wand, he doesn't want it. He wants his wand back that Ollivander said chose him, right? He puts the wand back into Dumbledore's tomb and says, if I die a natural death, its power will die with me. So the transfiguration of power, I mean, he uses that wand for the good of the community, ultimately. He doesn't use it to attack, he uses it to defend himself, which I think is really important. It's not two really skilled, angry people fighting against each other by attacking. It's one defending and one attacking. And so the defense wins. And then he puts that weapon away and says, I hope its power dies with me.
Yeah, and then the third one is the invisibility cloak and the transformation of self and community. And I think you've already talked a little bit about the, you know, the importance of the individual within the community as a part of that alchemical process. So what's that third section? How does that relate to the invisibility cloak?
Well, so as I mentioned already, I mean, Dumbledore reminds Harry that this cloak can be used to protect oneself, but also to protect other people. What a contrast between using the cloak to live a long life and then taking it off and going to death, thinking that there are worse things in the mortal world than dying, and something Voldemort never learns, and passing on that cloak to the next generation. So there's a different kind of relationship with death already pointed out by that cloak. So showing us again this alchemical idea that the Philosopher's Stone is not only about living, you know, like Voldemort wants to do forever by whatever means possible, but actually having a relationship with death where you can take off that cloak when it's time and hand it on to the next group of people. And what do you do with that life? What do you do with that cloak? How can you be an agent, not just for your own transformation, but for the transformation of the community? And this is pointing ahead to Plato when they're talking about justice in the Republic. And Plato says, wait a second, or Socrates says, okay, this is too small. We can see something bigger if we look at something that we're looking for in the small thing, the person, if we look at something bigger. So let's look at the community, because it's just like the person, only bigger. And if we want to figure out what the community is like, let's look at the stars, because they're just like human community, only bigger. So there's this alchemical idea that comes through in Plato. So I chose Purdom's article, The Snitch, the Sword, and the Stone, to start off this section. And coming back to something you said earlier, Emily, she talks about Harry as a seeker, trying to catch the golden snitch. But she also thinks about Harry as the snitch in himself. So he's both seeker and snitch. And she talks about seekers in Quaker meetings, looking, you know, seeking direct communion with God. Or for an alchemist, with nature's essential goodness and inevitable perfection. So Harry is a seeker. He's liminal. You're talking about going between two worlds, a kind of axis mundi, with his feet in the, like Socrates, feet rooted in the earth. And he is making a link between those worlds, both for himself, he's on his own journey, but also for the people with whom he lives. And so Purdom points out that he's seeker and snitch. Sometimes he's the intercessor, and sometimes he's the one who needs intercession. It goes both ways, but there's this metaphysical, spiritual journey there. The Philosopher's Stone and the elixir that are created from it, they're both part of who Harry is. The Sword of Gryffindor and the beneficiary of the sword, she argues, are both part of who Harry is. So he plays seeker in Quidditch, but this is an alchemy whose allegorical goal is wholeness, the golden snitch. It doesn't have to be literal gold. It's the gold of one's heart, the gold of one's soul, the goal of one's relationship with other people. So I thought that that was an important way to start off this cloak of invisibility section and the transfiguration of self and community. So Purdom is giving us background information about alchemy, but also bringing it into the context of what do you do when you have this invisibility cloak? you could use it to do dumb kid stuff like sneaking, you know, off into.
Well, we know they do that. Sneaking around Hogwarts.
Sneaking off into Hogsmeade when you're not supposed to go there. Or you can use it to protect people. You can use it to find out information to do good in the world. So her last line, Harry is most enduringly the youngest seeker in 100 years who communes directly with a higher power as a seeker should, interceding on behalf of the entire wizarding world and making it whole again.
Yeah. And so you end that section with your own chapter, which is about Plato, who's come up a lot. I like Plato. Aristotle makes me tired. I'm a big Aristotle fan, but I do like Plato. And your chapter is called Ruddy Stargazers, Centaurs, Philosophers, and a Life Worth Living, which definitely does sound like a good way to, close out the book, which is, it's really about like, how do you live a life worth living, not just a long life, right? So tell us a little bit more about this chapter and how you think like reading Harry Potter is also like reading Plato.
So I gave a short version of this chapter at the International Society for Neoplatonic Studies in Ottawa in 2019, when we could still go.
Oh, yeah.
And I said, I'm going to talk about a Neoplatonist newly discovered, J.K. Rowling.
Awesome.
And so I was thinking about, again, trying to make up for my Plato abuse when I was writing my dissertation, thinking about this modern idea, again, of the separation of mind and body and being critical of trying to move beyond the physical world. And I thought, you know, when Plato talks about being a stargazer, when he talks about the heavens, he's not talking about something so strange. He's talking about, look at the sky. As I mentioned just briefly a minute ago, in the Republic, when they get confused about what justice is in the person, and Socrates says, well, let's look at the whole community, because it's the same as the person, only bigger. And when they have a problem figuring out the community, look at the sky. The patterns in the heavens are like the community, only bigger. We're supposed to be modeling our human lives on what we see in the stars. And of course, a lot of people don't understand that. And they, in the Republic, talk about the philosopher as a stargazer, an idle babbler. And Hagrid dismisses the centaurs as ruddy stargazers, right? They can't give him a straight answer about something right here in front of their noses. They're always looking up at the stars.
And you know, yes, the kids also find some of that, especially like Harry, he finds some of that like really esoteric, you know, he doesn't totally get that, at least especially early on.
Well, and that's one, coming back to our initial conversation, that these are developmental. The education is not something that, you know, you swallow and spit it out on an exam and then you're done. I mean, so one thing about Aristotle, the idea that when you do something, at the beginning, you're just doing that kind of deed. I'm doing a courageous act, or I'm doing something terrible like Merope. I'm doing a terrible act by giving the love potion. If I keep practicing those things, it becomes part of my character. I become a brave person, or I become a manipulative person. Mm-hmm. So she stops. Basham argues that her character is essentially gracious. Harry does brave things often enough, so he becomes a brave person. Mm. The Harry Potter class is in our integrated studies program, and it's for juniors. And I argue that it needs to stay with juniors or maybe seniors, because it's a developmental thing that when they're juniors, they can see things that they probably wouldn't have seen in their first year.
Right.
Is it
I totally agree.
Harry doesn't understand the whole backstory when he's a little kid. He grows into it, not just his growing up, but his understanding of this world that he lives in. And maybe, yeah, of course, when you want information from a centaur, or you want information from Socrates, and you get another question back.
A riddle. Mars is bright tonight.
but that is a riddle that actually, if you pay attention to it, is telling us something important about fire and red and the rubedo stage and so on. The books make me laugh sometimes, especially that section with the centaur, because my brother and I used to say to my dad, we asked you what time it was, and you told us how to build a clock. You just tell us what time it is. So, but of course, as you just mentioned, the centaurs are looking at the heavens. And coming back to the idea of divination, they are looking for patterns for our human lives in the celestial world. They're doing alchemical work there because there is the quintessence there. It is eternal. It is unchanging. And if we can look there, we can find some clues for our lives. When Socrates talks about the common reaction, an idle babbler, he also shows that philosophers are stargazers in the same kind of sense that the centaurs are, looking at the pattern in the stars, in the heavens for our mortal lives. And so the stargazer, in that positive sense, is the one who might help us navigate the ship of state, in Plato's language, as true pilots, not as a power grab, not because they want to be in charge, but because they can see the big picture and help keep the whole thing safe. And the centaurs, as annoying as they can be, do that too. Whether Hermione should have used them to drive off Dolores Umbridge or not, I don't know, but they do help.
Yeah, that was satisfying though.
Schadenfreude.
If I ever hear somebody say Hermione is a goody two shoes again, you did not read the books.
She's a criminal mastermind.
She kidnaps Rita Skeeter and keeps her imprisoned in a jar. Hello.
Yeah.
She doesn't want her dumb boyfriends to break the rules just to go get some candy, you know, but she will break the rules if it's for the greater good, or if the rules are stupid, or if someone's being a tyrant. Mm-hmm. She's starting SPEW is breaking the rules of her culture, her new culture. But anyway, so this is why I'm thinking about stargazers as a central theme in both Harry Potter and in Plato. Yes, people use it to brush somebody off, but both of them are looking at the eternal in the stars and saying that's part of our mortal life. And since we are mortal, we don't always see the whole picture. But if we study and learn and try again and go through that developmental process, then there's a chance that we can find that gold in ourselves. And we need to have community to do that.
And you did something unusual in your book, in that you included the perspective of authors from age 8 to age 80. Tell us about your decision to include such diversity and what you think the result is.
Well, coming back to my favorite word again, serendipity, right? I was a student at the Harvard Center for Hellenic Studies in Washington, D.C. in the summer of 2017. And it was a workshop on the verbal art of Plato. So it made perfect sense. But I was talking about, then this book took a long time to come together. I was talking about working on the book. And one of my classmates says, I have an 8-year-old daughter who will not stop reading Harry Potter. And when I try to get her to read something else, she wrote me an explanation of why she's going to keep on reading Harry Potter. Wow.
I love that. That's living as a Hermione. Yeah. I'm down with that. Yeah. Making her own homework.
And she talked about the importance of Hermione, whom she admires. And she talked about learning cool stuff like Latin roots of words. Severe comes from the Latin word severus, as in Severus Snape. Severe means strict or harsh. That's how Professor Snape acts. And also malice means bad, like Mal and Malfoy. I mean, this is an 8-year-old. And I thought these books were written for kids. I've got to include some children's voices. So I asked my classmate if her daughter might write something, and she sent me the letter she wrote her mom. And I thought that was the coolest thing. And again, another sabbatical, I'm in Northern New York. And I didn't know this girl before this, but I knew her father. And we used to, my office away from home was a coffee shop in Potsdam, New York. And I was talking to dad, and what a sad story. Not many women die in childbirth anymore, but his wife did. So Ella, her little brother came home and her mom didn't.
Oh, how awful.
Awful, awful. But her father was telling me how much Ella loves Harry Potter. And I thought, this is just perfect. And this girl mm-hmm. who can understand what it's like to lose your parents young. Mm-hmm. And so he brought Ella and her best friend Claire to the coffee shop, and I bought them hot cocoa, and they were wearing their Hogwarts gear. And what an incredible conversation. I wanted to tell my students sometimes, I know a 13-year-old who can do this work. So don't tell me it's too hard for you to read this article.
Yeah, and I guess she had said too that it was her friend Claire who kind of kept hounding her to read it, and finally she read it and she was like, "Ah, these are the best," which exactly. I think a lot of people have that story too. And
then have it created that friend.
But it created like a bond between the friends as well, which is like the whole, that's what we're talking about within the Harry Potter story too.
Exactly. And she and Claire, they probably would be thick as thieves no matter what, but Harry Potter has made them inseparable, this bond between them. Speaking of the mm-hmm. transformations I talked about, And also, I thought it was so funny that Ella read a whole bunch of other books that she wasn't necessarily going to read because she was trying to avoid reading Harry Potter. So she went through her collection of excuse books. But so my students in the Philosopher's Soul class, they have one assignment called Meet Hermione in the Library. And I had, the first time I did this, a student thought we were actually going to meet in the library. So he was so apologetic, he didn't come to class because he was looking for us in the library. But I have a whole pile of books on reserve. And of course they have Google and a whole bunch of other things, but they have to do some research on where do these names come from? What's some background information? Why might something be told in a certain way? Ella did this when she talks about in the first potions class, Potter, Snape said suddenly, what would I get if I added powdered root of asphodel to an infusion of wormwood? And she looked it up and she finds that asphodel in Victorian flower language means lily, or my regrets follow you to the grave. Wormwood also means absence or symbolizes bitter sorrow. So Snape's first words to Harry were actually reaching out to him by saying, I bitterly regret Lily's death. You know, when we think by the end of the sixth book, when Snape has just blasted Dumbledore over the top of the tower, that he really is out to get Harry. And then we find out the truth. Not that he's nice to Harry, he's not, but there's a different way of thinking about what love means. And he's trying to give Harry this clue right from the beginning. I am sorry. He takes the offer that Harry made to Voldemort, try for some remorse, and it almost does kill him. I can't imagine living Snape's life of cutting yourself off purposely in order to say, I'm sorry for causing Lily's death and for saving her son. So anyway, I thought this was remarkable on the part of somebody who was then 13, doing this background research herself, and it made the series more intense for her. It made her into a more serious reader. And the students do that as well. When they're going out looking for the background information, they say, who knew that that name held such potent symbolism? And then I had a bunch of students who were going to write, not my students, but younger students, the beginning of the third section. Dumbledore's Academy, my friend Tammy Dixon Rankin, she retired right before the pandemic, but she had a Harry Potter club, and they figured they couldn't use the word army in middle school. So they were Dumbledore's Academy. And some years they came to the college, and some years my students went there. The last time we went, they made a Quidditch match for us. We played in the gym. The whole school came to watch. It was really fun. My students get out of the van, and all of a sudden, you know, they're 20, they're 21, everybody's 11. And it was just fabulous. And they love to come to the college, mostly, and they like meeting with my students and doing whatever we did in class, but mostly they love the cafeteria. And they really wanted to know, can we have seconds? Do you want an ice cream cone for each hand? You can have it. It's the coolest thing ever.
Where are the pumpkin pasties?
Yeah.
I have made cockroach clusters and cauldron cake, and I get dry ice from the chemistry
that's
department.
Awesome.
That's so much fun. But so some of Tammy's students were going to write. My niece was going to write. Some of my colleagues' kids were going to write. It didn't turn up. So I said, Tammy, could you just do this? Because you work with middle schoolers. You have this club. And she wrote this incredibly beautiful piece about her students. I thought she got the kids' voices in there just so. And she had a cancer diagnosis. She missed almost a semester. And one of her students gave her a piece of paper and said, don't read this until I'm gone. And she opens it and it says, all was well. I thought, wow.
Aww.
A middle school student and the teacher.
That's
that
wonderful.
Happens in Harry Potter books too. This teacher is learning from the students. It happens to me all the time in my class. And middle school student, we made it, Mrs. R. We made it through this terrible year. What a wonderful way to end this book, but also to think about all was well at the ending of the Harry Potter series. So I wanted to include those voices. And again, the 80-year-old, just serendipity. We had somebody else in Ireland who was supposed to be writing a chapter and she just ran out of time and said, here's my colleague. I think she could do it for you. I had no idea how old Mary was when she was writing, but it turns out she's a retired psychologist and she's getting a second PhD in English talking about psychological development in Harry Potter. She Zoomed in with my class last year along with Isaac Willis and Sean Paulsgrove, who's another one of my former students who has a piece in the book, tapping on just another brick in the wall. Who else would write about Harry Potter and Pink Floyd? this is perfect for Sean. And it was his senior thesis. And it was so funny. He would not let his parents read his senior thesis until the book came in the mail. Then they could read it.
That's awesome.
And he's in a master's program in communication studies. But, you know, the minute I met Sean, I knew he was a philosophy major, even though he was majoring in comm studies. And when we sat down and figured out how he could do the second major, that was the most wonderful, transformative thing for him. So I'm glad that worked out. And he also has a piece in the book. But again, so I just wanted to have kids' voices because the books were written for them. And I love that Dr. Mary Pyle is working on her second dissertation, and she got some of her thoughts in the book as well.
You know, I think, Anne, what you have talked about this episode with us, it's such a powerful reminder of how vitally important the liberal arts are for us. And I'm just coming back to this because it's a point that you brought up before, but it's also really dear to my heart. I think that we are in an era where higher education is being seen as really just job training. So the idea is, so, you know, you can get a job so you can make some money. You're going to go to college, but your life is a lot more than that. And these questions about how do I live a good life are so vitally important. And you can get to those through literature, through philosophy, through this kind of alchemical reading of the books that, you know, are part of our world. And so I just feel like that's just a really powerful statement. And I thought, you know, your chapter, you compare some specific things about Plato to Harry Potter. And it just reminded me again of how important this kind of education is, because it does transform individuals, and it allows individuals also to transform the communities in which you live. So we live. So very, just very central to, I think, the human quest. Well, thank you so much, Anne, for expanding our thinking about the alchemy of Harry Potter. Listeners, be sure to get a copy of Anne's book, The Alchemical Harry Potter. So much good food for thought there from a variety of perspectives. And you will see names that you're familiar with, like John Granger, Barbara Purdom, Lori Kim, but also you hear these new voices. I found it to be such a good combination. I think you will find plenty of really good food for thought there.
The book is published by McFarland, and it's an academic book. But at the same time, you know, McFarland is wonderful in that they price their books in an affordable way. And so it is an accessible purchase. I purchased mine on Amazon. So it is an accessible purchase. Sometimes when people hear academic book, they're like, I don't have $70, you know, but this is not like that, which is great.
And it's also very readable, which I totally appreciate. And, you know, in my books as well. So really great, great work there, Anne. And what a great combination of people you brought together.
Can I say two more quick things?
Sure.
One is to thank McFarland. But when you see the cover, there is a cat on the cover. The original cover design did not have the cat. And I thought, we have to have the Transfiguration teacher on the cover. Can we
Absolutely.
Have a cat? Professor McGonagall. And they got me a cat. And they were wonderful to work with. And thank you to McFarland for that. And a shout out to Lori Kim, who also went to Bryn Mawr College.
Oh,
I'm so pleased that she had her article in the book.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Well, you are also going to love my closing quote, Anne, because I also chose the Transfiguring Cat to give us the final word here. So we're going to end with a quote from Minerva McGonagall, who is the professor of Transfiguration. And this is what she said to the Hogwarts first years. Transfiguration is some of the most complex and dangerous magic you will learn at Hogwarts. Anyone messing around in my class will leave and not come back. You have been warned.
We hope you have enjoyed this episode of Potterversity. Send us your thoughts on the episode or propose ideas for future episodes by writing to potterversitypodcast@gmail.com. If you like the show, consider leaving a review on iTunes, and be sure to follow Potterversity on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Potterversity is brought to you by MuggleNet, the number one Wizarding World resource since 1999. Emma Nicholson is technical director, and the show is produced by Laurie Beckoff. Our theme music is performed by The Town, featuring Sean Elsburn, Scott Hacker, Travis Princey, Ashley Shepherd, and Emily Strand, and produced by Sean Elsburn. I'm your announcer, Dr. Sarah Brown.
Until next time, class dismissed.